Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. We're picking up speed from here on. The fulcrum that was the mid-19th century has passed, and our story is developing quickly. This is episode 203, the siege of Makapansgat and reconstituting history. It is 1854, almost midway through the sixth decade of this momentous century, and the region that's under our gaze is the Northern Limpopo Territory, the Waterberg. Those who live there today will know of its grandeur and its extensive mountain ranges, river-run bush, delightful geology. Tabu Mitse is the northern Sutu name for the Waterberg, where the average height of the peaks are around 600 meters above sea level, rising to 2,000 meters in places. The vegetation is officially known as dry deciduous forest, or just the bushveld to you and me. The original people here date back thousands of years. Early evolutionary stages of hominid development can also be traced here, so in many ways, it's part of the story of human existence on the entire planet. It's all about the type of rocks here and the soils. Clamber amongst the red kopjes and ravines, and you can look out over the bushveld with its minerals such as vanadium and platinum, part of the bushveld igneous complex I spoke about in episodes 1 and 2. Tectonic forces forced the rocks upwards, creating the famous Waterberg, the Tabu Mitse Ranges. Rivers deposited sediment, and in these sandstone layers, you'll find the famous caves surrounded by cliffs hundreds of feet high, rising from the plains. Scientists and paleontologists tracked our very first human ancestors who lived at the Waterberg as early as 3 million years ago. And inside the cave, we're going to hear about Makapansgat. Skeletons of Australopithecus africanus have been found. Homo erectus remains have also been found in that cave. This site has yielded many thousands of fossil bones, and what is known as the Cave of Hearths preserves a remarkably complete record of human occupation from the early Stone Age, Acheulean times, and the oldest sediments through to the Middle Stone Age, the later Stone Age, and up to the Iron Age, and even to the present. It also is where one of the earliest Homo sapiens remains have ever been found, a jaw discovered by archaeologists. The lime-enriched deposits and dry conditions within the cave have allowed for the exceptional preservation of plants, the animal, and human remains. As Amanda Beth Esterhazen points out in her 2007 Wits University PhD paper, which is online. This is a case of history following geology. The Cave of Hearths connected to the Limeworks Cave. Others in a 3 or 4 kilometre radius around here include Peppercorn Cave, Ficus Cave, Two Skulls Cave and Cold Air Cave. So it's really metaphorical, an iconic cave, because this is where the Boers and the Kakana people were going to go to war. Part of our story this episode is about a track, a wagon trail, that passed between the ivory hunting centre of Schoemansdal in Soutpansberg and the newly established Boer town of Pretoria, which cuts straight through the middle of Kakana Chief Mokopane's territory, and inside this territory is Makapansgat. Pretoria was established in November 1853 after Andries Pretorius purchased two farms, Elandspoort and Kuruspoort, to begin the settlement. The town was laid out alongst a steadily flowing stream called the Arpies River, first settled by ancient African groups, then the Bakwena people, who were chased away by Mzilikazi, himself freshly arrived from Zululand. Mzilikazi then moved further west to Mariko to avoid the AmaZulu impis sent by Shaka to hunt him down. By 1854, Pretoria had become an important stopover for the Boers from the southern Transvaal republics and Potchefstroom, for example, heading off to hunt in the north. Since the first trekkers had arrived in 1837, the Langa and Kakana people who lived in the Waterberg had watched in some disquiet as the numbers of Boers increased over the years. It was almost two decades after Louis Trichardt had wheeled his wagons through the Waterberg, and by the mid-19th century, there wasn't a week that went past without hunters or prospectors wandering through. It's a double irony, then, to relate, that both the Langa and Kakana had origins themselves further south. They were part of the Ama Ndebele, who had fled from northern Zululand during Shaka's reign, related to the Amahlubi, and had been involved in some land seizing themselves. Don't simplify history, it's more radical than a buffet hall of red berets. After arriving in the high veld, the group split into five chiefdoms, including the Kakana and the Langa. This splitting and moving and reorientating reveals the fluid nature of these groups, as they absorbed, became absorbed, split, moved, or formed alliances with other polities. Limpopo is like that even these days. A hot and quite mad place, but beautiful. The Kakana and Langa were mostly hunters and farmers, and the Kakana lived near Seokwala Hill, where Port Jesus Rus was eventually founded, a town which has subsequently been renamed Mokopane. More about that in a minute or two. The Langa lived further north. Livestock were a challenge here because much of the land was filled with tsetse flies. Fortunately, there was a lot of game wandering around the bushveld. The Kakana and the Langa altered the political landscape after they arrived, sometimes hiring Bapedi mercenaries to sort out succession battles and integrating themselves in a region that had been shaken up by Mzilikazi. With the Mzilikazi defeated in 1836, the Boers regarded both the Langa and Kakana as vanquished. Not fully understanding how the two chiefs regarded their independence, they weren't full vassals of Mzilikazi, although at times they had allied themselves with him. King Mgumbani Gagana of the Kakana and Mankopane of the Langa were not prepared to accept Treka overlordship. They rejected the Treka system of labour, where every black adult male was supposed to work for the Boers for nothing. Mokopane, by the way, is a northern Sotho form of Mgumbani Gagana, the chief of the Kakana, and he was known throughout the territory as Mokopane. What's in a name, they say. More about that at the end. Mokopane particularly rejected the Ingebukt apprentice system. It bonded men to a virtual lifetime of labour. It was a form of slavery. And both chiefs found it unacceptable that they were banned from buying guns, ammunition and horses, the most strategically important tools in the modern era, and tools being rapidly accumulated by African chiefs in the mid-19th century. Between 1850 and 1854, four Amandebele chiefs, Sebetiele, Mankopane and Maraba, as well as Mgumbani, had formed a loose alliance against the Boers. The full extent of this network is unknown, but a letter written just after the siege of 1854 by the Trek Boers in Leidenbach to J.P. Hoffmann, who was the newly installed state president of the Free State, suggests that the web of connections included Basutu King Moshweshwe, who was in a position to provide guns and ammunition. In 1854, the Boers, who were also finding it increasingly difficult to exert control over Sekwati's Pedi people, had shifted their trade routes from the Straatpoort to the Makapanspoort, and in doing so triggered a cycle of violence, resistance and retaliation between themselves and the Amandebele. Thus, the wagon road was going to cause all the trouble. Mokopane had been feuding with the Trekkers since 1847, when he was raided by the Boers for cattle and labour. This is where the son of Andries Hendrik Potgieter, Piet Potgieter, enters the picture, but only for a short while. Piet Potgieter succeeded his father as leader of the Soutpansberg Boers. The other Boer of significance in this story is Hermanus Potgieter, Piet's uncle. The man had been a problem for the Volksraad due to his uncontrollable ways, but his actions in 1854 led directly to a series of massacres. In May 1854, Veldkornet High Heer van Staden from Gallisberg reported that Hermanus Potgieter and 19 other Boers had attacked a chief called Ramagabutla and his people and robbed them of all their cattle and seized their women and children. Ramagabutla was an ally of Kakana chief Mokopane. The war council of the Treka government gathered and instructed Potgieter to restore the stolen cattle to Ramagabutla and to return all the abducted women and children to the chief. Potgieter ignored the order and repented. No further action followed. Hermanus had been emboldened by the passive response. Who could enforce the law here in the wild lands of the Bushveld? No one. He was free to do as he wished. A dangerous precedent. A few months later, in September 1854, Hermanus Potgieter was out hunting when he stumbled across Chief Mokopane's younger brother, who had just shot a buffalo calf. This infuriated Hermanus, and he yelled at the young man because he believed only full-grown buffalo should be hunted, not the calves. The argument developed, and suddenly Hermanus lifted his musket and shot Mokopane's brother, dead. Then the Boer rode off. When Chief Mokopane heard about this shooting, he demanded revenge. Mokopane was an old man. His son, Mokopane II, was waiting in the wings to succeed his father, so the chief was under extra pressure to take action. Hermanus Potgieter was aware of whom he had shot, but didn't seem to care. He was symbolic of the roving colonial hunter of the time, pretty much a law unto himself. Mokopane moved fast. He wanted his revenge as a meal served piping hot. The Kakana chief planned to trick Hermanus using one of his junior chiefs, Mapela, of the Langa people, who lived nearby. The trap was an invisible herd of elephants. Mapela sent word of this mythical herd to Hermanus. Hermanus was an ivory hunter, and the news had the effect of a moth to a candle. Hermanus Potgieter and eight other Boers hurried to Fortani Hill, where Mapela's messenger said the elephants were grazing. A large party of Langa men were waiting for them, and a large tusk was displayed to show Hermanus what treasures awaited. What the Boers did not know was that the large group of men were Langa warriors, and they'd broken off the hafts of their spears and were hiding the long, sharp blades under their carosses. As the Boers surrounded the tusk, studying it, they were attacked by the warriors, who killed all except Hermanus. He managed to fight off his attackers and ran to his wagon, just as a powerful Kakana warrior called Karesa chased him down and then stabbed him repeatedly. Hermanus managed to grab his musket, but it was too late. He fell dead before he could fire back. Mapela sent news to Mokopani that his brother had been avenged, but the chief was not satisfied. This was unfortunate for two Boer families who had outspanned their wagons on the main trail at Mahalakwena Ford on the Nail Rafid, about 10 kilometers south of Potgieter's Rus. This was the main road now, the main road I mentioned, used by the Boers and hunters from the south to move through Mokopani's land without so much as a bow your leave. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Willem and Nelly Prinsloo and their three children, along with Jan and Maria Briet and their three children, were at the Mahalakwena River crossing. So too were Lorenz Bronkhorst and Philippus de Pria. They were going about their business when the Kakana warriors descended. It was September 1854. There is some confusion about exactly which day, but the 14 were taken by surprise. All were killed. Still, Mokopani was not satisfied. Two more Boers, Meneer M.A. Venter and his son, knew nothing of all these killings and arrived to barter corn at Mokopani's great place, which was southeast of Potgieter's Rus. Both were duly dispatched. Another Boer who had travelled into the region rode to Mokopani's great place in September. Heer Engelbrecht was blissfully unaware of all the blood that had been shed. He traded his hides and biltong for corn and other grains from the Kakana, then was stopped from leaving by the chief. Engelbrecht had no idea that his life was hanging in the balance, as Mokopani and his counselors debated what to do with this Boer. After 3 days, he was allowed to go free, and just a little later, he was informed by other Boers about the killings. Why was he allowed to live? Kakana oral tradition has it that Engelbrecht treated the chiefs honorably, fairly, and respected their ways, so he was spared. But Mokopani had also decided his vengeful wrath had been satiated, and his people were also satisfied. He had shown strength. What better way to prove power than magnanimously allowing Engelbrecht to live? The big problem with blue on black, tears on a river, joker on Jack, to quote Kenny Wayne Shepherd, is like for like, because as the saying goes, when you seek revenge, dig two graves. The killing feedback loop had begun. The Boers of the Waterberg were intent on their own revenge and sent for reinforcements from Rustenburg and the Soutpansberg, and finally a large Waterberg Boer commander of 480 men gathered, then set off in October 1854. Mokopani and thousands of his followers rushed to the large cave called Makapansgat for refuge when they got wind of this posse. This geological feature is now center stage. Caves are places of gloom, used by our ancestors across the globe to seek shelter from the weather, wild beasts and each other. Given the background I've outlined to the Makapansgat caves, it is ironic and emblematic that this clash of peoples was going to take place here. With all the bones littering the geological layers, another set were about to settle on the floor of the cave. There was divination going on. Traditional healers tried to cast their spells, but in mid-October the Boer commander arrived at the foot of the cliffs and looked up at the cave entrance. Behind the entrances, in the darkness, the extensive defensive perimeter thrown up by the Kakana made a direct attack impossible. The Dolomite cave had two access points which were relatively low-hanging, and these opened into two enormous and imposing chambers behind. To approach the openings, attackers had to climb from the foot of the mountain to the summit, exposing them to musket fire, as well as rocks and assegais being flung from the heights. The Kakana used rock to build outer defences, and more rocks were piled up inside the two entrances. And inside these chambers, gorges led away to other passages within, which fed other chambers and other passages. The original labyrinth, it was a sanctuary, but for a large number of the Kakana, it would become their tomb. Before the Boers arrived, the Kakana had stocked up with food and water, as well as gunpowder and lead. It was an underground stream that flowed through the cave, providing water. The defenders were well armed. Taking this cave was going to be difficult. The Boer commander attacked at dawn on the 25th of November, 1854, storming the cave complex. They used two field guns to blast through the outer defences and were stunned to find four wagons hidden behind the stone redoubts. Fighting furiously, the Kokona retreated to the second wall of rocks, their inner perimeter. These were the days of muskets. Acrid smoke filled the air, and in the chambers a smoke screen developed. And after taking two casualties, the Boers withdrew in the afternoon. They returned for two more days, trying to break through the inner perimeter, but failing each time. By now, they were aware of just how complex this cave system was. Not only was it a labyrinth, the passageways inside the chambers were also dotted with rocky outcrops, ideal for Kokona gunmen and spearmen to hide behind. It was pitch black inside. Any further attempts at taking the cave in a direct frontal assault was suicidal, so the commander met on the 28th of October to discuss next steps. They did have access to barrels of gunpowder and wedged these above the chambers, setting off huge explosions, but the roof of the cave did not collapse. The limestone absorbed most of the force and just cracked in about a dozen places. The Boers now had a big problem. They had just set off most of their prized gunpowder and could not repeat their blasting. Changing tack, the Boers brought up wagon loads of wood instead and set fire to these at the foot of the mountain, trying to smoke out the Kokona. The smoke drifted away. It had no effect on the defenders. The Boers then began building mobile stone redoubts and advanced behind these as a kind of constructed shield. Their sharpshooters began to take a heavy toll on the Kokona gunmen. A few days later, the Boers discovered the source of the stream that flowed through the cave and then diverted the precious water. Somehow, the defenders inside were still making it out of the cave at night. There were numerous rocky outcrops and thick bushes, and the Kokona managed to slip between these out of sight in the dark, replenishing their water and their food. So the Boers brought in 300 local Africans who cleared all the vegetation and rocks around the entrances. Day 15 of the siege, the 8th of November. Commander Piet Potgieter ordered that the two entrances be blocked, and it took the 300 black workers 5 more days to pile up rocks, shrubs and stones, stuffing them into the gaps, locking the Kokona inside. On the last evening, just before the entrances were finally shut down, some Kokona made a last-ditch attempt at escaping, rushing the exits. The Boers were waiting and shot down most of those trying to make a run. It was said that 700 men, women and children died in this attempt. It's probably an exaggeration. One by one, the defenders, though, began surrendering, and by the 12th of November, more than 400 women and children had been rounded up. The Boers sent a letter requesting more gunpowder from the Volksraad. It never arrived. With friends like these, you could say. On the 17th of November, another 364 women and children emerged, and on the same day, the Boers managed to enter the cave system. The warriors were either dead or had somehow managed to make their escape. The Boers found guns, decomposing bodies, some lead and powder, and other items left by the Kokona. Where were the men and where was the chief, Mokopane? This had now dragged on for weeks, and many members of the commando began growing restless. Their horses were also dying of horse sickness because the rains had begun. Some wanted to go home and begin their planting season. They had spent 28 days in this place and 39 days in total away from their homes in the bushveld. Their gunpowder was running low, and the booty of livestock had not materialized. Time to call it a day. Mokopane was still free, but in the last days of the siege, Piet Potgieter was going to pay for his assault on Makapan's hut. In one of the attacks, a Kokona sniper picked off the Boer commander, and his death brought an end to his family's hegemony in the north. The commander never fully explored the caves. To give you an idea about how vast this cave system is, the main cavern extends more than 750 meters back. The darkness is complete, and your attacker could be lying a few centimeters away, and you'd never know until it was too late. The Kokona were decimated by this siege, although Mokopane was apparently alive. Tradition speaks of Mokopane then losing his mind and committing suicide. Other oral history has it that he lived for some years in the future, but in reality, the Kokona had been dealt an almost fatal blow. Mokopane disappeared. Just because history is history, they would make a remarkable return, the Kakana, but it would take more than two decades. Recently, archaeologists have found the remains of young and old people and the desiccated bodies of a child and a young woman, and all speak of untold suffering and provide a glimpse of the horror within the cave back in 1854. From this, it is reasoned that following the devastation of the siege, the core of the chieftain was challenged. The chief was dealt with, and the political power base shifted away from the Kakana. The Boers had captured 34 guns, 1,200 calves, 3,300 cattle, and 784 women and children. The farmers shared out the captive Kakana women and children like livestock, while the livestock was actually sold to cover expenses, and many went towards the families of Potgieter and the Boer wounded. The nearby Langa people under Mankopane were also still technically at war with the Boers. It was a Langa chief who had killed the hunting party after all. This seemingly unrelated distant battle in a cave was to resonate far further afield and far longer than you'd imagine. It's also an extended mystery because Kakana oral history is pretty mute about what happened inside the caves. It is silent on the main events that preceded and occurred during the siege itself. Whatever happened inside those dark chambers was too terrifying to recall. A young Paul Krier was one of the commando members, and he speaks of Hermanus Potgieter's remains being skinned and of some of the bodies of the victims at the river crossing being decapitated. Mahala Kwena Ford was then renamed Moertrif, Murder Drift. Apartheid-era historians latched onto this narrative. The siege would be reconstructed in an elaborate way as one of the rationales for the separation of all races in South Africa, that a heinous crime had befallen the Boers because they got too close to the Kakana. Back to the small village of Vredenburg, which appeared on the Makapansgat Valley in 1852, which was renamed Potgietersrus after Piet Potgieter, who had paid the ultimate price. And, of course, renamed Mokopane in 2003 after the man who disappeared from Makapansgat. But if you remember the beginning of this episode, Mokopane's real name was actually Mgombane Gagana, so someone bungled that naming changeover. Everyone refers to this place as Potties if you go visit there. South Africa's infatuation with identity can be pretty convoluted, as we all know. The remains of those who died within are still being found in this cave system. Recently, archaeologists found unusual relics, such as European flow blue ceramics, which the 1820 settlers brought with them to the shores of Algoa Bay. How did these beautiful ceramics end up in Makapansgat in the hands of the Kakana 30 years later, smashed alongside the bones of the defenders of the cave? Strange but true. Was it a woman who had traded grain for a plate? The intricate flow blue, quite beautiful and sought after. Flow blue is a style of white porcelain that originated in Staffordshire amongst the potters of England. The name came from the blue glaze that blurred and flowed during the firing process. Flow blue remained in vogue for most of the Victorian era, but unbeknownst to the original artist, one of the intricate plates lay in Makapansgat until discovered in 2007 alongside the bones of its Kakana owner. Remarkable. Just for the record, the Makapansgat Valley and Cave is now a World Heritage Site. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can email me from there too. Until next, Sapela Khabotsi.